Preaching the Parables by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. A series given the seminar for homiletics renewal at Biblical Seminary back in 1984. What are the parables? How do we interpret them? How do we apply them? Preaching the Parables is a series of talks given at a homiletics renewal seminar at Biblical Seminary back in 1984. My three main presentations were entitled, What Are Parables? How Do We Interpret Them? How Do We Apply Them? What are parables? The English definition of the word parable, given in Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, is a usually short fictitious story that illustrates a moral attitude or a religious principle. That's not bad. Common literary definition is an extended simile, where we then need to know what a simile is. A simile is a figure of speech in which a comparison is explicitly stated, for example, as big as a barn, or big like a barn. A parable is longer, a sentence to a story, and it makes an explicit comparison, so it's an extended simile. For example, the kingdom of heaven is like. And then the story I'm going to tell you is the picture, the illustration of what the kingdom of heaven is like. The New Testament word parabole, Greek word, as used in the New Testament, has a broader meaning than the English word parable. It includes proverb, we'll see an example in Luke 4:23, and paradox, Mark 7:17, as well as various types of illustrative stories. This is probably due to the influence of the Old Testament word mashal, which we'll discuss by and by. Proverb, Luke 4:23. Jesus said to them, "Surely you will quote this proverb, parabole, to me, physician, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum." So physician, heal yourself is the proverb, and then the application is that given by the crowd. Paradox, Mark 7:15, nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it is what comes out of a man that makes him unclean. And then jumping down from Mark 7:15 to Mark 7:17, after he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about this parable, parabole, this nothing going outside a man can make him unclean, which we would call a paradox. The Old Testament word mashal is the general Hebrew word for a comparative figure speech. It includes proverb, and we'll get an example from 1 Samuel 10:12, but in fact the title of the book of Proverbs is this word mashal, mashalim, plural. Byword, and we're going to look at Psalm 44:14, but there's also an example in 69:11. Parable, Ezekiel 17:2 and 24:3. Prophetic poem, Numbers 23:7, and a taunt song, Micah 2:4. We'll look at a sample of each of these. Proverb, 1 Samuel 10:12. A man who lived there answered, "And who is their father?" So it became a saying, mashal, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" Now the context of this passage is where Saul has been prophesying. Okay? Told by Samuel what's going to happen to him, and about a day later, as these things are being fulfilled, he begins to prophesy. Byword, Psalm 44:13 and following, "You have made us a reproach to our neighbors, the scorn and derision of those around us. You have made us a byword, mashal, among the nations. The people shake their heads at us." So byword, basically a synonym to reproach, scorn, derision, etc. "My disgrace is before me all day long, and my face is covered with shame." Parable, Ezekiel 17:1, and we'll come back and look at this parable now and again. "The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set forth an allegory, and tell the house of Israel a parable, mashal. Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. A great eagle with powerful wings, long feathers, and full plumage of various colors came to Lebanon," and then goes on with that story. Prophetic poem, Numbers 23:7, "Then Balaam uttered his oracle, mashal," and we then begin this prophetic this prophetic poetry. Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come, he said, curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. And that goes on. Taunt song, Micah 2:4. In that day, men will ridicule you, mashal you. They will taunt you with this mournful song. We are utterly ruined. My people's possession is divided up. He takes it from me. He assigns our fields to traitors. So, both the word parable in Greek and the word mashal in Hebrew have a broader meaning than our modern word parable, which is obviously borrowed from parable. What are the types of stories that we find in the New Testament that are called parables? Well, we can categorize the illustrative stories in the Gospels into several different sorts. First of all, a similitude. This tends to be short. A common process or generic activity of some sort, which teaches a lesson. For example, the parable of mustard seed in Mark 4:30. We'll look at a sample of each of these in a bit. Parable proper, a specific story, rather than a common process or generic activity. Specific story, which teaches a lesson by means of comparison. For example, the parable of the tenant farmers in Matthew 21:33. An allegory. An allegory is a more artificial story with individual features independently figurative. Example we use is the parable of the sower, Matthew 13:18. A paradigm. A paradigm is a specific story which teaches by example rather than by comparison. Now, there are six of these in Luke. They're all in Luke. And we'll look at the rich fool, Luke 12:16. Acted parable. Here the teacher, speaker, whatever, performs a symbolic action or, alternatively, a historical incident has symbolic significance. The word is used twice in the book of Hebrews, once for the tabernacle service in Hebrews 9:9, suggesting that the tabernacle service activities are symbolic actions, and once for Abraham offering Isaac in Hebrews 11:19, which Abraham did not know he was doing an acting parable, but it turns out to be in the long run. Here's a similitude. Mark 4:30 and following. Again, he said, Jesus speaking, what shall we say the kingdom of God is like, or what parable shall we use to describe it? It's like a mustard seed, which is the smallest seed you plant in the ground, yet when planted, it grows and becomes the largest of all garden plants, with such big branches that the birds of the air can perch in its shade. So basically telling you what happens when you plant a mustard seed, if you like. And so it's not a specific story, though the Jesus has chosen the mustard seed as opposed to certain other seeds. And it's going to be a comparison to something about the kingdom of heaven. Parable proper, Jesus says, listen, Matthew 21:33 and following. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a wall around it, dug a wine press in it, built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. When the harvest time approached, he sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one, killed another, stoned a third. Then he sent other servants to them more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They'll respect my son, he said. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to each other, this is the heir, come, let's kill him and take his inheritance. So they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Well, here's a story. You can see it's longer than the similitude is. It's got a comparison of some sort in it. This incident of a landowner with a vineyard and his tenants, refusing to pay the rent and mistreating his servants and finally killing the son, etc., is an analogy to God who put the Israelites in their land, and they regularly beat up on the prophets when they came to try to get them to do what they're supposed to be doing, living righteous lives, and then finally they kill God's son, etc. So we've got this analogy between the earthly story and the heavenly meaning, if you like. Allegory, you remember, said lots of points that are independently figurative. Well, Jesus has given the parable of the sower back earlier in Matthew 13, and now in Matthew 13:18, he begins to interpret it for us. Listen then to what the parable of the sower means. When anyone hears a message about the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is the seed sown along the path. The one who received the seed that fell on rocky places, is a man who hears the word and at once receives it with joy. But since he has no root, he lasts only a short time. Verse 22, the one who received the seed that fell among the thorns is a man who hears the word, but of the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth choke it, making it unfruitful. But the one who received the seed that fell on good soil is the man who hears the word and understands it. He produces a crop yielding 100, 60, or 30 times what was sown. Well, here's an analogy also. there's the analogy between the sower, who is like God or one of his servants, and the seed is like the gospel message, the message about the kingdom, as Jesus says here in verse 19. And then the various kinds of soil represent various kinds of receptions for the message. And you need to have several of these things explained to you before it's obvious then what the parable's about, and even some details in particular ones, that the birds plucking away the seed on the hard ground represents the evil one, and that the lack of root is because the seed didn't penetrate below the bedrock, which is under the thin topsoil, etc. And the thorns represent the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth, etc. So there are several things that need to be explained. That's what we'd call an allegory. A paradigm or sample parable. This is the one out of Luke 12, verse 16 and following. He told this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He, the rich man, thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. And he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take it easy. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God. Well, here's a story again, an illustrative story again. But in this case, we're getting a sample of a certain kind of foolishness. The fellow becomes wealthy, and he uses his wealth to build up his security, even to the extent of tearing down some stuff he had good. And he does that rather than being rich towards God. And so this is a sample of the kind of activity which here, in this case, Jesus is condemning. And he explains that in verse 21. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God. It's a little different. The others are analogies. This is a sample. Acted parable. Matthew 21:18, parable of the cursed fig tree. Early in the morning, as he was on his way back to the city, he was hungry, this is Jesus. Seeing a fig tree by the road, he went up to it, but found nothing on it except leaves. Then he said to it, may you never bear fruit again. Immediately the tree withered. In the Gospels, none of these things are explicitly called parables, but on the basis of the two examples from Hebrews, where something similar, the temple service and the incident with Abraham and Isaac, are called parables, I think we can call these active parables too. They, in fact, parallel actions of the prophets in the Old Testament, which are often acted parallels as well. How many acted parallels, parables did Jesus do? Well, it was this one, cursing the fig tree. Probably the one cleansing the temple. Probably washing the disciples' feet at the Last Supper would fall in that category. And we could probably work out a few more besides these, but I'll leave it with those three. How are parables used by Jesus and by the rabbis and by others who tell parables back in that period? Well, one use is basically rhetorical use, to capture the audience's attention by asking questions, by getting them to be involved, by surprising them in various ways, by telling a story that has suspense in it, etc. So captivate the audience's attention. Secondly, and we'll give a sample of this from the Old Testament, to sneak by the audience's defenses. The author of the parable is seeking to get a moral judgment from someone before that person realizes that that moral judgment is going to condemn themselves. Thirdly, to impress a lesson vividly. We'll look at a sample out of Jeremiah 9, 10 through 13 here. Luke 15 has a sample of this, the parable of the Good Samaritan. to change one's way of looking at a situation. Important use of parables to get us to look at a different perspective on a situation, typically God's perspective on a situation, where we've been looking at it from our perspective. I'll give Mark 3:10, I believe, here's our sample. To mystify one's opponents, John 2, verses 18 through 22 will be the sample we'll look at here. And to provoke further thought, Matthew 13, 51, 52. Well, let's look at each of these rather quickly. Sneak by the defenses. 2 Samuel 12, 1 and following. The Lord sent Nathan to David. David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, and now the prophet Nathan shows up with a rather difficult assignment to get David to repent over what he's done. When he came to him, Nathan came to David, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him. Now, this translation is perhaps not ideal. I think from David's reaction, we're to get the idea here that Nathan is telling him an account of something that actually is going on in one of David's cities. And David becomes very angry when he finds out about this. And then after he makes a judgment, this fellow deserves to die, but at least he's got to pay back what the law requires. Then Nathan says, you're the man. So designed to sneak by his defenses. Well, Jesus uses that kind of approach on several occasions as well. I gave you one example back there a couple panels ago where he has the story of the two debtors, which he uses to get his host to make a judgment that then shows that Jesus is really doing the right thing in when this woman pours the perfume over him. Secondly, impress a lesson. Jeremiah 19:1. This is what the Lord says, talking to Jeremiah, go and buy a clay jar from a potter. Take along some of the elders of the people and of the priests and go out to the valley of Ben-Hinnom near the entrance to the potsherd gate. There proclaim the words I tell you. And then the intervening verses here. Give those verses. Then break, this is verse 10, then break the jar while those who go with you are watching, and say to them, this is what the Lord Almighty says, I will smash this nation and this city just as this potter's jar is smashed and cannot be repaired. They will bury the dead in Topheth until there's no more room. So, impressing a lesson, this acted parable, if you like, of smashing a clay jar is a parable of what's going to happen to Jerusalem, and it's very effective to impress that. One of the few things I still remember explicitly from my course in chemistry at Duke University was when the professor put a tennis ball into a little beaker of liquid oxygen and then pulled it out with tongs and threw it against the wall and it smashed into pieces. Press a lesson. Change one way of looking at a situation. Matthew 3:9, do not think you can say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. I tell you that out of these stones, God can raise up children for Abraham. The axe is already at the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. So here's John the Baptist giving this parable, actually. Says, don't think that you guys are you guys are going to be okay because you're children of Abraham. God doesn't need you. And the way you need to look at the situation is that you are trees which are not producing fruit, and the owner is getting ready to cut you down. Right? So the parable designed to give them a different perspective on their situation than the one they have, which is erroneous. Mystify opponents. John 2:18. Jesus has just cleansed the temple. Then the Jews demanded of him, what miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and I will raise it up again in 3 days. The Jews replied, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So here's a sample in which Jesus gives something that's mysterious, but they remember it. They remembered, in fact, several years later at his trial. But it's also a prediction, which the disciples realized then, after he'd risen from the dead, that that's in fact what he predicted. Destroy this temple, and I'll raise it again in 3 days. It's possible that Jesus even explained it to them after his resurrection. So, mystify of one's opponents. To provoke further thought, at the end of Jesus' parables, the kingdom, in Matthew 13, he says in verse 51 to his disciples, have you understood all these things? Jesus asked. Yes, they replied. He said to them, therefore every teacher of the law who has been instructed about the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of a storeroom new treasures as well as old. I want you to think about these things, he's basically saying. And gives them a parable of that sort, a parable of a householder who, when he's got guests or visitors or something of that sort, shows them around his place and shows off the treasures he's got, and not only the treasures he's recently got, but also the old heirlooms, etc. And teachers of the law who've been instructed about the kingdom, we might say today, Christian pastors and leaders and such, should be learning and have new stuff to teach as well as the old stuff that they've known for a long time. That they should do both. Parables to provoke further thought. Okay, that's a little bit about what are parables. How do we interpret parables? Well, we interpret them by observation, rather than by bringing in a full set of hermeneutics of parables and then running our parables through a meat grinder or something that cranks out automatic interpretations. We look at how the parables operate. We interpret them by observation. I found it helpful to compare Jesus' parables with rabbinic parables. We'll do a separate PowerPoint talk on that, though, so I'll just say bring some results here. We look at the Old Testament background. Parables of Jesus are given in a culture that's much more like the Old Testament background than it's like our culture today. And we come to realize that a number of misconceptions have arisen about parables by ignoring some facets of their use. For instance, the misconception that parables are earthly stories with heavenly meanings. Well, that in fact is true for most parables, but doesn't work for all parables. It doesn't work for those six paradigm parables in Luke. Rich man and Lazarus, the Good Samaritan, the guest at the banquet, the rich fool, etc. That's a few of those six. I'm sure I'm going to crack them all off the top of my head. Those parables already have the spiritual meaning in the earthly story itself. It's not a different level. Basically, the story is a sample of the thing. So the rich man and Lazarus is a sample of what happens to two people when they die. And we need to make some generalizations from that. The rich fool is a sample of a rather foolish type of behavior that one can very easily get into and need to know about that or not do it, okay? So, a second misconception is that parables are intended to clarify. This is true for many parables, but not true for all parables. One has to reject the passage Matthew 13:10 and following, where to hold a view of this sort, and a number of liberal theologians have done that. Matthew 13:10 and following, the disciples came to him and asked, why do you speak to the people in parables? He replied, the knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you, but not to them. Whoever has will be given more, and he will have abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. The idea that the parables are mysterious is explicitly stated here. It doesn't say that all of them are, but that some of them are. And that was rejected by many liberal theologians in earlier years, and still is. And yet We can see by looking at the rabbinic parables that some parables are mysterious. By looking at Old Testament parables, some of the parables are mysterious. Madeleine Boucher wrote her doctoral thesis, The Mysterious Parable, which is well worth looking at in this regard. Another misconception. Parables are intended to mystify. Well, this is also unbalanced. It's true for some parables. It's not true for some other parables. Note, for instance, that about 16 parables occur in the Gospels before Jesus' remarks in Matthew 13 about these mysterious parables he's telling about the kingdom. And some of those parables are quite clear. Another misconception is that parables make only one point. This is a widespread error that started in Germany around 1900 or shortly before with Adolf Jülicher, and came to show up in many rather orthodox texts on parables as a reaction perhaps to the tendency to allegorize parables. Well, actually, when we look at the parables, and this whole section about observation, we find that some parables do make only one point, and some don't. We have to decide from the amount of detail the parable gives, the context, any interpretation that's given, how many points there are that the parable makes. Well, some observations. From looking at Old Testament parables, we can learn some things about parables. We can see that parables may take the form of realistic stories, as in 1 Kings 20, or very contrived stories, as in Ezekiel 17, and even a realistic story need not be historical, that is, need not refer to an event that actually happened, 2 Samuel 12. Realistic, 1 Kings 20. As the king passed by, a prophet called out to him, "Your servant went into the thick of battle. Someone came to him with a captive and said, 'Guard this man. If he's missing, it'll be your life for his life, or you must pay a talent of silver.' While your servant was busy here and there, the man disappeared." "That is your sentence," the king of Israel said. "You have pronounced it yourself." Well, realistic. King of Israel thought that he was getting a true story from the prophet here, though in fact the prophet had had somebody wound him and he'd put a bandage over it, the blood presumably oozing through. But in fact, what he's about to do is to sneak up on the king of Israel, sneak up on his moral defenses, and get the king to give a judgment against him, against the prophet, which in fact is God's judgment against the king of Israel. The king of Israel let his enemy go, which God had handed over to him. Huh? Realistic parable. Huh? A contrived parable, Ezekiel 17, verse 3 and following. "Say to them, 'This is what the sovereign Lord said. A great eagle with powerful wings, long feathers, and full plumage of varied colors came to Lebanon. Taking hold of the top of the cedar, he broke off its topmost shoot and carried it away to a land of merchants, where he planted it in a city of traders. He took some of the seed of your land and put it in fertile soil. He planted it like a willow by abundant water, and it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine. Its branches turned toward him, and its roots remained under it. So it became a vine and produced branches and put out leafy boughs," etc. Well, the story at least sounds to us rather contrived, that an eagle is cutting off a part of a cedar tree and replanting it somewhere and that sort of thing. And it is kind of an allegorical story, but it's a parable. And so they can be rather realistic or they can be contrived. And I think the original readers would have realized something like this was contrived, but also would have realized it's teaching a lesson. Even a story that sounds straightforward can be non-historical, 2 Samuel 12, about the rich man and the poor man in the certain town, and the rich man taking the ewe lamb from the poor man, etc. Yeah, that's not historical. It's a story that Nathan has made up to get David to judge himself, and he does. So a parable can be a fictitious story. It doesn't have to be. It can be a fictitious story, and that in itself has no problem with inerrancy, because that's part of that standard genre. Further observations. Interpretations of parables may be given, Ezekiel 37, or not, Isaiah 28. Obvious, Isaiah 20, or not, Zechariah 5. Interpretations may be simple and natural, Isaiah 5, or peculiar and complex, Ezekiel 17. interpretation given. Ezekiel 37, God has just given Ezekiel the vision of the valley of the dry bones, and these bones begin to come together and form sinew and flesh on them, and then Ezekiel's told to breathe in them, and they come alive. Then we get the interpretation, verse 11. Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, Our bones are dried up and our hope is gone, we are cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, This is what the sovereign Lord says. O my people, I'm going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel. So the interpretation is given that the bringing of life back to these bones is like giving life back to the nation of Israel by bringing them back to their land of Israel. Interpretation may be not given. Isaiah 28, verse 24 and following. When a farmer plows for planting, does he plow continually? Does he keep on breaking up and harrowing the soil? When he's leveled the surface, does he not sow, caraway, and scatter cumin? Does he not plant wheat in its place, barley in its plot, spelt in its field? His God instructs him and teaches him the right way. Caraway is not threshed with a sledge, nor is a cartwheel rolled over cumin. Caraway is beaten out with a rod and cumin with a stick. Grain must be ground to make bread, so one does not go on threshing it forever. Though he drives the wheels of his threshing cart over it, his horses do not grind it. All this also comes from the Lord Almighty, wonderful in counsel and magnificent in wisdom. Now here, Isaiah doesn't give us the interpretation of this. He's giving us a sample of a lot of activities that a farmer carries out in growing crops and in preparing those crops for use, etc. And we would have to look at the context and see how that is apparently to be understood in what the message of Isaiah is there. Obvious, Isaiah 20. At that time, the Lord spoke through Isaiah, son of Amos. He said to him, Take off the sackcloth from your body and the sandals from your feet. And he did so, going around stripped and barefoot. Then the Lord said, Just as my servant Isaiah has gone stripped and barefoot for 3 years, as a sign and portent against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away stripped and barefoot the Egyptian captives and Cushite exiles, young and old, with buttocks bare, to Egypt's shame. Those who trusted in Cush and boasted in Egypt will be afraid and put to shame. In that day the people who live on this coast will say, See what has happened to those we relied on, those we fled to for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. How then can we escape? Well, pretty obvious here what's going on. Isaiah is to do an act in parable in which he dresses or undresses, if you like a captive. Typically the armies, when they took captives, they stripped off all of their clothing, or at least all their good clothing, and took that as plunder. And so Isaiah's going around like he's been plundered, and it's a message we see here about what's going to happen to Egypt and Cush. Not obvious. Zechariah 5. Then the angel who was speaking to me came forward and said to me, Look up and see what that is, what this is that is appearing. Verse 6. I asked, What is it? He replied, It's a measuring basket. And he added, This is the iniquity of the people throughout the land. And then the cover of lead was raised, and there in the basket sat a woman. He said, This is wickedness. He pushed her back down into the basket and pushed the lead cover down over its mouth. Then I looked up, and there before me were two women with the wind in their wings. They had wings like those of a stork, and they lifted up the basket between heaven and earth. Where are they taking the basket? I asked the angel who was speaking to me. He replied, To the country of Babylonia to build a house for it. When it's ready, the basket will be set there in its place. So, not obvious. Not a whole lot of interpretation given. Wickedness is being taken away to Babylonia. Is that what's going on there? Something like that, but not a real clear explanation. Something to make us think, if you like. Huh? Natural. Isaiah 5, I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines, built a watchtower in it, and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now you dwellers in Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done for my vineyard than I've done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I'm going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall and be trampled. I'll make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated. Briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. Well, here's a picture of an owner with a vineyard, and it's going to go on to say in the parable that the owner represents God and the vineyard represents Israel. And so the owner does the sort of things you would do to prepare the land to be a vineyard, but he doesn't get good grapes from it, and so he's going to let it go back to being a wilderness, if you like. Peculiar. Here's an example of a peculiar one. It's this Ezekiel 17 one about the eagles and the top of the cedar tree that's been plucked off and replanted. Here's the interpretation of verse 11. Then the word of the Lord came to me, say to this rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Say to them, the king of Babylon went to Jerusalem and carried off her king and her nobles, bringing them back with him to Babylon. That's the first bird. Then he took a member of the royal family and made a treaty with him, putting him under oath. He also carried away the leading men of the land, so that the kingdom would be brought low, unable to rise again, surviving only by keeping his treaty. But the king rebelled against him by sending his envoys to Egypt to get horses and a large army. Picture in the Ezekiel 17 of the lion turning towards the other eagle. Will he succeed? Will he who does such things escape? Will he break the treaty and yet escape? Surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, he'll die in Babylon, the land of the king who put him on the throne, whose oath he despised and whose treaty he broke. Pharaoh with his mighty army and great horde will be of no help to him in war, when ramps are built and siege works erected and destroyed many lives. A rather peculiar type of story given there. Well, some observations from rabbinic parables. Those are observations from Old Testament parables. I see my PowerPoint talk, rabbinic parables. For sample rabbinic parables and some observations about them. Rabbinic parables are not too easy to find a copy, find a text of, compared to, say, Jesus parables. Zondervan some years ago published a book by Harvey MacArthur and Robert Johnston entitled They Also Taught in Parables, which gave a number of samples. It was a work developed from Johnston's doctoral thesis. Johnston's doctoral thesis is available from university microfilms. Well, see my PowerPoint talk, Rabbinic Parables, for sample Rabbinic Parables and some observations about them. Here I just repeat the observations. Parables vary considerably in complexity, Rabbinic Parables. Some make only one point. Some have several analogies. If no interpretation is given, one needs to study the parable structure to see how detailed the fit is likely to be. As oral teaching devices of experienced instructors, the parables of Jesus and the rabbis don't waste words. So presumably, all the words are used either for vividness, make the story vivid, or to develop the analogies. So you have to ask when you see a word or phrase or something of that sort, is that just part of the vividness, or is that actually part of the and is that something that gives you information about how to interpret it? Is that part of the analogy? Parables of Jesus and the rabbis regularly make use of stock similes, most from the Old Testament background. What's going on there? Well, that means that if we see a word or a phrase in a parable, we should at least think about whether that's got an Old Testament figurative usage or not, and whether that gives us any hints about what the parables mean. Both the rabbinic parables and Jesus' parables make heavy use of the simile of God as king and humans as his subjects, etc. We'll also see God as father and God as husband in some of the rabbinic parables and some of the Old Testament parables, and you'll see some of that as well in the Jesus parables, at least the father one in the prodigal son. So you should check for the Old Testament figurative usage of any elements in your parable. What's the significance of the this guy not having a wedding garment in the parable of the king's wedding feast in Matthew 22? Parables may also make use of features from everyday life that would be familiar to the hearers, but often not to us because we live in a rather different culture. There we're looking at a often rural agricultural context, and not nearly as many people live in those kind of contexts today, at least in the U.S., and we're living in a pre-industrial economy back there, and up here we're not, etc., so those sort of things. We may need to study these cultural elements to aid in interpreting these. We have some recent reference works that are helpful in this direction, besides Alfred Edersheim's old Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. He's working with rabbinic background, and that can be helpful. A couple of works on parables by Kenneth Bailey are helpful on cultural background. And then we have the InterVarsity's Bible background commentary that the New Testament section of that has got some helpful materials in it as well. The formula which often starts a parable out, A is like B, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant, something of that sort. This formula, A is like B, which often introduces a parable, is ambiguous. Though it often compares A with B, it may instead compare A with the whole story. You have to look and think through the context and the structure to see which of those two is more likely to be true. Well, that much on interpreting parables, if you like. How do we apply the parables? Well, my suggestion is first we explain the parable story to our listeners, then apply it. We don't just jump in with the applications. We want the people that are listening to us to understand the story. We try to recover the vividness and emotional impact the parable had for its original audience. And this sometimes gets lost in various ways. For instance, a Pharisee today means a hypocrite, whereas Pharisee back in Jesus' time meant a rather serious study, a student of Scripture, though obviously some of them were hypocrites. But meant that, and so would have different impact. A talent today means some ability, and that's actually has spun out of the parable of the talents. But at Jesus' time, a talent was a rather substantial amount of money, typically 60 to 75 pounds of silver. It was the amount of a talent. So there are things like that that need to be explained so that our audience can and picture the thing vividly and can see the emotional impact the parable had. We shouldn't leave the congregation feeling the parable has no application to their own situation. So, explain the parable first. Well, we need to realize when we're preaching sermons that in addition to being exhortation, a sermon is also a teaching device. We want to make the congregation as self-sufficient in Bible study as we can, not spoon-feeding them. We may feel more like we need it if we're spoon-feeding them, but in fact we're not doing them good in the long run. It's like trying to keep our kids children all the time when they need to be growing up. Therefore, they need to see where we're getting our lessons from. We need to show them how that arises out of our passage, and that that protects us against inventing lessons from passages that aren't really the lessons aren't really there. If they see how the lesson, the application arises from the parable, they're more likely to remember it the next time they read the parable. So then they can help. They can apply it to themselves when they remember it, or if they're trying to help others, they can apply it to those that they're trying to help. Huh? When we try to recover the vividness and impact of the parable, this makes the parable easier to remember for our audience and easier to use, not to mention more interesting. So we need to use historical cultural information. We need to think about the Pharisee and the tax collector and how those two kinds of people were viewed back then. Huh? We need to think in the prodigal son, what's the impact of the father, a man with grown children running to meet his son? The two debtors, we need to explain the relative size of the debts and also the absolute size of the debts as well. The 10,000 talents in one of those parables is a humongous amount of money. It represents the whole tax income from a province. How do you get a debt that big? In recovering the vividness and impact, we don't want to explain away the intended peculiarities. Jesus' parables often have peculiarities, and we sometimes miss those things. They're intended to be caricatures sometimes, and a surprise, in fact, is often a main point of the parables. The crookedness of the steward and the crooked business manager, and the crookedness of the judge, and the woman and the unjust judge. The king's cancellation of the first servant's forgiveness. The owner sending his son when the tenants have already been mistreating the servants. Those are peculiarities, and they involve surprise of one sort or another. Don't abandon the congregation. Since your audience is different from Jesus' audience, try to figure out the proper generalization of Jesus' parable to apply to us. Huh? Crooked business manager, for instance. Part of the point that parable is surely making is that even unbelievers have sense enough to take action when they see they're going to lose everything. And we need to ask our audience, do you have sense enough to take action when you see you're going to lose everything? Parable of the sower. The gospel received different responses. Application. Which response are you making? Parable of the 10 virgins. We often talk about the Lord's coming being maybe very soon. And are you going to be ready? Parable of 10 virgins makes a little bit different point. Will the delay of the Lord's coming be too long for you? Can you hold out in the long run? We need to make proper generalizations. Parable of the two debtors, and I'm thinking about the one with the 10,000 pounds and the 10,000 talents and the other one with the much smaller debt that's owed him by the 200 denarii, I believe it was, that's owed him by the other, and he forgives it. He refuses to forgive this smaller debtor. We need to raise the question ourselves, have I really been forgiven? And one of the points this parable is truly making is, does my life show it? If I've really been forgiven, I have become a forgiving person, or I need to become a forgiving person. The parable of the vineyard workers, the day laborers, we might call it, the guys who worked all day get the one denarii they had bargained for, and the guys who worked only 1 hour are graciously given a denarius as well. Question, is God unjust in not giving me what he gave somebody else? Be very careful about those kind of questions and those kind of attitudes. Parable of the wheat and the weeds, the wheat and the tares, tells us that we're not going to be in a perfect world. We're not going to have a perfect church until Christ returns. And the serious application, am I wheat or am I weed? Well, that's the end of this quick tour. May God help us to properly interpret and apply Jesus' parables, our preaching, teaching, counseling, that we may use this material helpfully in a way that others may profit from it.